So back to what I was saying.
Wow. I found out that was A&R's favorite cereal. So I sent him Frosted Flakes box in FedEx package, and he laughed his butt off.
I ran up on Dominique Wilkins and VIP at 112. Like, all I need is $1 million for my movie. He was like, oh my God, get away from me. Get away from me. Back to what I was saying.
What's up, what's up, what's up, friends, family, and fans? Welcome to Life On Podcast. This is where we listen and inspire friends in entertainment.
And everywhere.
Yeah. Because life happens to everyone. And right now, we are lifing with the one and only, the incomparable Mr. Teddy Pendergrass, a.k.a. Rob Hardy.
Hey, what's happening? How y'all doing?
What's up, Rob Hardy? How are you, man?
Hey, man, life is good. It's good to be here.
Are you shaving?
Am I shaving?
The eyebrows?
Oh, nah. That's just how they grow.
They're just doing what they're doing.
Because
your eyebrow muscles, is that what they're called? You look like the Silver Surfer.
That's hilarious.
That sounds like a shot. That's what I'm saying.
No, it's not a shot.
I'm going to call that wisdom and good genetics.
So if you haven't seen the Silver Surfer, look at it, and he actually has a very cool look. He has that whole little thing, and your eyebrow muscles do that. They look just like
that. Actually, just came out recently. It was a Whoopi Goldberg. They just found out on The View, like, her coworker said they've been sitting next to her for years and didn't know she didn't have eyebrows until that episode. And it's the same.
Because you have strong eyebrow muscles, whatever that is.
So it's Silver Surfer.
That's the one from what you call it, right? From Fantastic Four, right?
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You learn something new every day.
Every day.
That's right. That's why I'm here. So what's up, man? So Rob is, I'm going to let you explain what you do, but just so y'all know the history. So Rob actually been on the podcast before. It was a while ago. It was during COVID, but that was just whack. I'm going to just call it what it was. The information was awesome. The podcast.
We weren't together when we did that.
No, we weren't. I was in my man cave. You were there. He was at his house, and the quality was horrible, and COVID was happening.
Thanks, Zoom, for the horrible quality. Appreciate that.
Right. But it happened, and the information was good, but I had to get you back.
Hey, man, look, I appreciate the love.
Nah, you know? This is my guy. So we have a ton of really, really good conversations on the phone all the time. Yep. We don't mean to. They just turn into them. A lot like us. And I was like, man, I gotta get this guy back on because he be dropping too much stuff. Like, people need to hear it. But Rob and I, we've been friends since, 17?
Yeah.
So which puts you at like 16, 15?
Yeah, I was like 15. I was like 15 when I met you.
Yeah, so in high school. And then we've just been friends ever since. And so you are a TV and film director.
I am.
And that's one of my questions too. I'm going to ask, or you can get into it, because I want to know if you're going to get back into film. Are you still in film? Are you doing TV or what? So if you don't mind, tell everyone a little bit, just your come up story real brief, because that's kind of not the total of it all. Y'all can always Google them. You can find them very easily. But so Rob Hardy, tell us a little bit about who you are and how you came to be.
Hey, so my name is Rob Hardy.
Skip the sex part.
And originally from Philadelphia, PA, and got my start there, taking a video class when I was in middle school. Enjoyed it. Knew a guy with a camcorder around the way. We wound up just shooting a couple little music videos just for fun. People liked it. Kept that going. Went to boarding school with you. And actually, your roommate, a guy named Fred, had a camcorder.
He sure did.
And we wound up shooting some stuff on his camcorder.
I wore that camcorder out.
We didn't think to actually get the tape back to keep the footage. So he, you know, might have recorded over our stuff.
Right. I may have, actually.
I mean, listen, it could happen. But that like started and like set the tone. Shot a movie there my senior year, again, for fun. Went to FAMU, the Florida A&M University in Tallyho, Florida. And some friends of mine saw what I did in high school and was like, let's do that here. So hooked up with a guy. I wanted to be the filmmaker. He wanted to be a business guy, Will Packer. And we did our first movie together, Chocolate City.
Well, hold on. We got to give the boy the shout out, man.
Listen.
Gerald, my brother.
His brother.
Was the first star of his first movie. So we got to give Gerald his shout out.
He was G-Man.
He was G-Man. He was a superhero G-Man. Hey. Gerald Stafford. Look him up on Instagram. Follow
I didn't know
him.
That.
He was the first superhero of Rob Hardy's first movie.
He was. Hey, listen, he had gadgets and everything. He knew all his lines. He did.
He tricked out the golf cart.
100%. Gerald was representing. He had a poster, t-shirts, everything. So shout out to Gerald Stafford.
That was when you hit fast forward to make the golf cart go like supersonic.
Yeah, we did. I mean, everything was crazy low tech.
It was awesome.
Back in those days.
It was awesome.
You know what I'm saying?
I'm not even kidding though. On some real B movie type stuff, you might want to re-release that joint.
On Tubi,
just
hey,
on some
Run it on Tubi?
On Tubi.
Well, see, I don't really have no contracts on G-Man, Tubi. So okay. They have to just be on the internet for free. Okay. You know what I'm saying? For the free.
But go ahead. Yeah, yeah.
But so. Yeah, but that's basically because that had happened in high school, and I knew people in Tallahassee. A bunch of us put our talents together. Will and I bonded instantly at FAM, shot this movie, Chocolate City. FAMU supported it like they always do. We had
and another co-friend of ours, high school guy, Lee Hudson.
Lee Hudson, yes.
J.R. Swinger.
Right. So Lee Hudson, who was J.R. Swinger, went to high school with us also. And he wound up getting a production deal with Motown. Yep. And so he was in Miami recording. He wrote this song, Chocolate City, for us. And played that as a demo for Teddy Riley. Got a deal. They released it on a Christmas on a Stop the Violence compilation album, and then paid us to shoot the music video in Tallahassee. So that was my first time getting paid for something.
Nice.
And so we shot it, and it came out. So we were the first movie shot at a historically black college campus by the students, and we had a music video on Rap City.
Yep, I remember
so
that.
So all that was going on, so it made it a big deal. We were in Blockbuster. Cut to Will and I moved to Atlanta, and we started off with an independent movie called Twa with Kenya Moore, and worked our way up through Sony from independent guys.
We just want to skip over the opening shower scene.
Oh yes,
of
yes,
Twa,
yes, yes. My fault.
That
my
your
fault,
boy
fault,
was
fault.
In.
Okay, no. so then after Twa, we put it out in theaters. It made a little bit of money, and then we go back to Sony. They said, "Well, how about a Twa 2?" And we were like, Twa 2? Nah, we want to do something like The Best Man or The Brothers. That was hot back in those days. But then, you know, we needed like electricity, you know, and food. So we turned Twa 2 into Pandora's Box. And we actually shot that partially in Stone's house. Mm. Stone made a cameo.
What? The worst.
As a cop.
The worst. Okay, so please, look. We keep it 100. I have been wanting to say this, not ask you, but say this from day one so that you understand I know what it is. The worst acting job you have ever seen in your life. And the problem was my reads were better. But then when that camera came on, I'm walking from one bedroom to the living room. Had to be all the five steps. Your boy was out of breath.
You had this huge Bowie knife in a plastic bag.
Plastic bag. Exactly. Now, like, I found a knife. It's right where you said it was.
It was like, okay, cut. One more time.
And then make you do it again.
Exactly. Just relax. You know, you're in control. You know what I'm saying? You are the experts. Let's make it happen.
That was hilarious. I've been wanting to say that around you literally for years, and I just keep forgetting. Just so you acknowledge that I didn't think it was great at all.
Listen, it is still in the movie, and so look, if you see Twa 2 Pandora's Box, you will see Brother Stone as the cop with the knife.
Can I tell you a story you don't know? So, I used to run Sony here. We had an office right around the corner, DeFore Hills. I'm walking into the office. A lady, African American lady. I say that because it's a black movie, so you might be some surprised if some white people saw it back then. But she walks into the building. She goes, I know you.
Wow.
And I was like, now I'm with Sony and I'm out and about. So I'm like, well, do you do music, whatever? She goes, no. She just looked really familiar. I said, I think I just have one of those faces. And she goes, okay. I said, well, have a good day. I put my key in the door. She goes, you found the knife. I didn't even know how to react. I was like, what? First, I was like, don't take this wrong, because I wasn't like, you saw that movie? But I only say that because of how bad my acting was. Listen. So, I'm new to the game. So, I'm just thinking how bad my acting
was.
So like,
she remembered you from that movie.
And then I'm like, I said, you're kidding me. Because, no, you were that cop that found the knife. Didn't you do a movie or something? And I was like, well, actually, yeah, I did. I did have something for me to sign.
I must say, though, that wasn't Stone's only cameo, right? So, after that, we did a movie called The Gospel, which was Idris Elba's first movie after he left The Wire. Mm-hmm. So, we did that with him and Boris in Atlanta. And then we did Stomp the Yard.
Stomp the Yard, yeah.
So, Stomp the Yard meant a lot because it was like 10 years to the day of us moving here, and we did the Black College Show movie, Chocolate City. Now we're doing the Black College movie again, Stomp the Yard. And there was a new line, And Brother Stone, so what we did was we called all our homeboys. So everybody was like pushing 30, but they're fronting like they're like 18, they're 19. 17. Everybody's clean shaven, so lips look real long, all of that stuff. And so if you look on that line when the new Muse come up and Stomp the Yard towards the back of the line, you will see Stone. There are so many other like folks that we have from Atlanta that's all on that line. It's just, we just put all our boys in that movie.
And it's my head. You see, my nephew saw that. Brooklyn. I don't know if you met Brooklyn. He's like, son, I saw you in Stomp the Yard. And he would say that every single time. I said, and then I would look at the scene that he saw me. He just saw like this much of my head. I have a big head, though.
He was there.
Anyway, Rob was trying to put a boy on.
Hey, man. So that was Stomp the Yard. That was our first number one movie 2 weeks in a row. A bunch of other movies filed. Thank you. Think Like a Man. You know, movies like that, No Good Deed. And then I started doing television.
Yeah.
And I got into TV through the show ER and Criminal Minds, Vampire Diaries. And I've done a lot of TV shows. I got a chance
Flash.
I did The Flash, Arrow, Black Lightning.
So you were in The Flashverse. I guess it's The Arrowverse.
The Arrowverse.
I call it Flashverse.
I did the first three seasons of Flash, most of the first part of Arrow, and I did Black Lightning.
I was going to ask you about that. Before Black Lightning, you know, went away, did you get a chance to put your hands on that a little bit?
I did season two of Black Lightning, and then I set up a show here called The Quad, which was like now the TV version of Stomp the Yard, and also did the first episode pilot for All American, and then later on for Raising Kanan, the Power prequel. So I've been in the Power verse for a while.
I remember that. Yep.
So
I'm proud of you, man.
I appreciate you, man. Seriously. So yeah, that's where I am. I do a lot of TV. I have some movie stuff coming up soon.
Oh, good. That's what I want to ask you about. So what? I mean, I don't know if you can talk about it or whatever, but it's nice to hear that you're getting back into film.
Yes.
Is this your first film project since you? I don't want to say you left film, but since you focused on TV, is this your first one back?
Yeah. Okay. So the last movie I did was in 2010. It was Stomp the Yard Homecoming a while ago.
Wow, okay.
With the late, great Twitch and Collins Penny, Poopsaw, Tika Sumter. But I have a movie that's set up at Amazon with Viola Davis called Two Butterflies.
Nice.
So family drama about two sisters dealing with some personal tragedies.
Are we in pre-production or post right now with that one?
Well, right now we are looking to cast the movie.
Okay.
So that's kind of where we are. Okay. And I have a new movie that I'm really excited about too that we're developing with Desi Banks. You know, so excited about that. So that should be a big, more action comedy situation.
How involved are you with the casting? Like, does that decision primarily come down to the producers or to the director, and you're the director, right?
I'm the director.
So is that primarily your decision?
No. Okay. So the way that it works is that, you know, depending upon what the role is, sometimes everybody puts in suggestions of who they think would be good for the role. If it's an offer situation, like, oh, I really want to get insert name, Denzel Washington or Taraji P. Henson. Well, that's an offer situation, right? And then you would meet with that person and say, oh, Taraji wants to do this. We all like Taraji. Boom, there we go.
Gotcha.
If it's not that, if you're casting somebody, all the people come out and maybe as a director, I'll give notes on different performances. Then everybody, you know, says who they like and in what order.
And who's everybody?
So it'll basically be myself, the director. If it's TV, then it'll be the writer. So it'll be the director, the writer, and a producer. So all three of us will then weigh in. And then based on, you know, who we liked and that's the main person and maybe we have an understudy. And then that gets kicked up to the showrunner who runs it and to the network. So both of them weigh in and say, yep, we cool with all these choices, except we like choice number two over here. And that's how the casting happens.
Nice. TV. Never knew that.
And it's...
Yeah, because he just handed you your job and then you fumbled it. Like...
Yeah, that doesn't even
right.
count.
They were like, yo, we saw Pandora's box. He cast that one dude. I don't know. I don't know. We need to weigh in.
Like, who picked him? And everyone's like, that's cool. I never knew how. I always want to know how that casting process worked. So that's cool.
And it's also, too, because, like, even in features, the bigger the budget, the less autonomy you have. It's because after a while, when folks are spending a whole bunch of money, millions of dollars, they're like, yeah, that sounds amazing, Stone. You also want to see who you're casting to.
Like, park that pin. Put a pin in it.
So that way everybody weighs in. So it's like gumbo. You know what I'm saying? You figure it out collectively.
Interesting.
But you definitely have a lot of input in who those people are. And then as a director, you get a chance to give direction to try to prove your case. This person can take direction. They can do this. They can do that. They can do that. So then if it comes down between two people, then that's how you justify going with the newer person versus maybe somebody that's more established.
So I got to know. Go ahead.
Working with we talk about range as far as one actor goes. On a bunch of your projects, you've worked with actors that are in different ranges of their careers.
Yes.
Going back to the Stomp the Yard stuff, you had Keith David was in there, Columbus Short.
Yep.
Pooch Hall, I think, was in that first one. Tika Sumter.
Tiana Taylor, shout out.
They've all gone on to do, you know, amazing things in their own right. Like Keith David is one of my favorite voice actors ever.
His voice is so dope.
And I mean, he's an amazing actor, a stage actor, and theatrical as well. Yeah. Being a director and dealing with that range in one movie, you come into it through the casting process of having done your research. You've seen the works that they've been in. How do you create a niche for each of those different dynamics in whatever project you're in and direct them out of what they've been known for?
I think it's, it's first about having a conversation about what the vision is for how everything comes together. It's giving them and asking enough questions of the writers and stuff like that to figure out what the perspective and the tone is and knowing some things about backstory to give them the tools to create an authentic character. I may have something in mind as far as what I like, but then they're gonna inhabit it and make it real. So then once I kind of see what that is, it's like, oh, different from what I thought it was. So let me give a note to see what you do with that. Nice. That helps me kind of shape what it's going to be. Mm-hmm. So as opposed to me dictating every step of the way, I just provide light posts. And then within that, you discover everybody's process. Mm-hmm. Gotcha. Some people want very little direction. So like I've worked with some actors that if you're going to give a note, you better know exactly what you're saying. Right. Or they're going to be like,
I'm Patti LaBelle.
Yeah, listen, man. You know what I'm saying? So you're like, nope, I got it. Just on this one beat, you know what I'm saying? And then everybody kind of gets where you are and you figure out who needs what. And you, try to service that.
I have a certain degree of emotional intelligence in order to do that job well, I think.
Yeah, do you find yourself being a therapist almost, not a counselor in a sense?
Yeah, sometimes. And I think a lot of the counseling is managing your own emotions. Mm-hmm. Because I liken directing to playing football, right? So you're out there on the field and you do some good stuff and the crowd is cheering and yada, yada, yada. You go and take a sack, throw an interception, fumble the ball. There's grumblings, you know, who's the other guy on the bench? You know, bring him in, you know, whatever that is. You're trying to manage the game and you're figuring, okay, if I can just get 10 more yards, we can make it to the first down. I'll have the next scene. Mm-hmm. And if I do enough scenes and make up my time and beat the clock and have more wins than losses, I'm going to lose some, but more wins than losses. And, you know, and we look at our final score, that's what's going to determine, you know, whether I come back, you know.
I want to get into your sauce a little bit. Yeah. Every director, every creative that's a storyteller has their own process. You hear about directors that like to shoot sequentially. I've heard of some directors that like to shoot in reverse sequence. Some directors shoot the shots that they can get, you know, for whatever the set is set up. Are you like a sequential shooter to where you can follow the story as you go for production so that your notes in order? Or do you base it off of budget? It's like, hey, we got this set, so we're going to shoot every scene that we have on this set first and then get out of order. Like, what's your thought process? Or is it project by project?
It's project by project.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, you know, and all of it is like schedule driven and actor driven as far as what you shoot where. Mm-hmm. My process is I'm a visual storyteller, so I want to make it so that way when you watch what's happening on the screen, you know everything from what's on the screen. Okay? So I know everything about Stone should be about what's around him, what's on his wall, what kind of music is he playing, what kind of mood is he in, et cetera, et cetera. You know? And to try to tell a visual story so that way somebody from Kansas or Kalamazoo can say, okay, I know who that is, and here's why I should care about that. Mm-hmm. So it's all about what are the human qualities about the story that make us care. whether it's, you know, vampires, drug dealers, or teens. So, you know, that's generally what my approach is. And from a visual standpoint, I overly prepare. So I'll come out and, you know, make shot lists and do all that stuff and have plans for everything I want to do. And then you get out there and you talk about it with the actors and you see what stays. They may say, nah, what we want to do is this.
The actors.
Yes. Because you go.
But obviously, we're talking about certain levels of actors that earn the right to do that.
Well, yes and no.
Okay.
I think you come out there, everybody's approach is different. Mine is, I have a plan for how I see the scene going. Mm. Based upon what the scene is about, et cetera, et cetera. And then you guys will hear the plan and then we'll try it and see what feels natural.
Okay.
And then there's a discussion about it. So then that way, the scene organically finds itself, but I'm not just waiting for that to happen, you know, through magic. I'm not coming out here unprepared like, well, what do we want to do? Right, nah. Right. You're coming from here, but here's why you're going here. Here's why you're doing this. So this, everything is motivated.
So you have a reason for
every, it. Everything is motivated.
And then, I can see where I can help an actor get into it too.
Yeah.
When you have the purpose of like, you're not just stepping over here as a, what do you call it when you have markings?
Blocking.
Yeah, you're not stepping over here because it's a blocking thing. You're stepping over here because, oh, he made you feel this way and you're shying away.
And your intention is to do this. Your intention is to do that. So then that way, when they go through it, it's like, okay, now we see what you're going for, Rob.
That makes so much sense.
Then they take that and then they enhance it. And then they feel comfortable like, oh, well, you thought enough about this. Now I feel comfortable playing.
Mm-hmm. That,
you know what I'm saying?
Is dope. I never knew that. I mean, you see it.
Yeah.
Obviously, if you do the job well, you see it. But then you don't think about the fact that, oh, that's why.
That's how you know it's been done well. When it's over-prepared and over-thought out and over-detailed, it sucks you into the world and then you get lost in those details.
Sounds like you're super easy to work with as a director. So
that was going
to
be the next question. How hard is it to work with?
Well, I was going to say, are you considered kind of, this is kind of standard, or are you like, I'm a bit of an exception. Like, I'm one of the easier ones, better ones. And don't. Look,
yeah,
you're
no,
a humble
no,
guy
no, no,
anyway,
I got
so,
it. I got
yeah.
it. You know, everybody has their own process. And I don't really. When I was getting started in, so film versus TV, film, as a film director, you're on an island, okay? I wrote it or you wrote it, and you're the producer and I'm the director, so it's mine, it's ours. And any of the other directors out there, I may see them at the party or whatever, but we don't kick it. Television is different because every episode is like a chapter in a book. Mm-hmm. I'm doing chapter 11, you did 7, you're doing 19. So I can see you and there's no threat of competition. It's like,
we're all
yo,
on the same book.
Yo, tell me how 7 was. Okay, watch out for someone else. Oh, okay, cool. Yo, when you get to 19, watch out with da da da. So it's more of a camaraderie.
Yeah.
So
makes sense.
When I was coming up in TV, I had to shadow or apprentice under other directors, even though I was already a film director. They wanted to know if I could, you know, be more of a team player. Mm-hmm. So every director has their own approach. And, you know, my approach just happens to be I want to be a visual storyteller and I want to be an actor's director. That's
actor's
important to me.
Director.
Yeah, so I want to know, like, the story is what's up here. Mm. So I know what we're talking about, but what are we really saying?
Right.
It's like, baby, I love you. Baby, I love you. Yeah, baby, I love you. You know what I'm saying? It's three different scenes with the same words.
Yeah.
So I'm interested in doing that. There's some directors that only care about the visuals and they're shot lists.
It's the way you said that. That felt cold.
No. Listen, but listen.
Wham, bam, thank you, ma'am, director.
Yeah, listen. You know, there are some directors that are like that, and there's some directors that say it has to be this exact way that may work, but you may not necessarily give the actors a little bit of freedom,
creatively, way.
Yeah, to bring some magic to it.
Yeah. Which is why you got them in the first place, I would think.
Well, if it goes that way, because sometimes you don't have a say in who you get, right?
Correct. I mean,
it depends.
Or sometimes you have an actor that wants to make it whatever they want it to be. That's got nothing to do with what's on the page.
Now, that's where I can see the crap hitting the fan.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Yeah. That's when you're. So I will say this: I did a TV show one time years ago, and when it was starting. It was, you know, a cool show and everybody was cool. Then it became a massive hit. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, some of the actors were tougher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they say, I don't think I want to do it that way. What I want to do is this. So then that's when, like, you know, the showrunner has to come in and have conversations. It's got nothing to do with you. It's just your time.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So however long it takes to work that out, your time on the clock is still going and it's still ticking.
So that showrunner's got some clout.
Well, yeah, because it's there. They created it, and they got to deliver all the episodes, yeah, and they're on the hook to the studio.
Oh. That's your usually your showrunner.
I heard that name because the showrunner sounds like such an intern title.
Yeah, usually a showrunner is like the lead writer in the writer's room, right?
Well, it's the same thing. Yeah. So the showrunner is so like, you know, if I'm showrunning a show, typically I create it.
Right.
Insert name, the Red Cup Diaries. Mm-hmm. I create the Red Cup Diaries. I set it up and I'm over delivering all the episodes and I'm over the writer's room. So we'll talk about what we're going to do. I'm writing one, you two, you three. We'll keep recycling. But I break the tie. Mm. I'm the final say-so.
Oh, man.
So then if there's an issue, you know, then I as a director will defer to the showrunner and saying, hey, I have an actor here who's feeling like this scene shouldn't be about this, even though that's what we discussed in the room.
Showrunner is always the one who created it?
Not always. Okay. Usually.
Because sometimes you have someone who created it, but they had no idea how to be a showrunner, though, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. So that's like you create a show, but you didn't necessarily have enough experience to make the money decision, people comfortable. Yeah. So they'll go get, you know, Stone. And so technically you're the creator. It was created by you. Mm-hmm. And you'll run the show or be the supervising producer.
Now, I'm going to ask you
that with authors.
Ask you this. Does this happen? Because that still happens a lot, obviously. But mm-hmm. do you still kind of end up being like defaulted to being one of the writers in the writer's room, or are you seeing sometimes that like you can just hand the story off or hand the show off and the showrunners take over and then the writer who created it is no longer a part of it?
It depends on who the showrunner is.
Okay. Yeah,
you have some showrunners that play well in the sandbox and they have more of a giving spirit, mm-hmm. and they're like, listen, I just want to supervise. I'm here to support you. I'm going to get a check regardless. Mm-hmm. I'm going to get a credit regardless. And then you have other people that are more selfish and their thing is like, nah, if I'm going to do the work, I'm gonna do it long enough till it's mine. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? And then you're out. You're out.
You're out of it.
And then I'm doing my thing.
As a director, I've always been interested in this. I've never dug deep into this because a lot of times your fingerprints almost add to the writer's room indirectly, in a sense, even when you have to change scenes and stuff like that.
Yes.
How does that work on the back end crediting wise? Like, do you end up getting a writer's credit as a director? Okay. All right. I never knew that got super intricate.
So that's why they're hiring me as a director.
Okay.
What they want to do is they want to say, we want you to draw a picture of a clown. Okay. And the clown needs to kind of look like this. And then your job is to come and deliver that clown to those specifications, but you can, within reason, color it how you want to, or shade it, or add these things that make it your own unique thing, but it's still a clown to those specifications that they want.
Gotcha.
And depending upon how amazing of a job that you did will determine, I want this director person to come back again because of how they shaded this clown.
Now, you know the musical equivalent of that is going to be the engineer in rock and country. That's what the engineer does in rock and country, not in R&B mm-hmm. and hip hop and stuff.
Interesting.
In rock and country. In rock and country, the engineer also is usually typically called the producer.
A lot of times.
Because they make those decisions right there.
Yeah, 100%.
Nice. I love that.
And that's what's elevating the material. So you bring in certain directors, like there's certain people that'll come in and do just what's on the page. I asked for this, you delivered this. then and again, that's no shade. It's just more so what's in your brain.
Sure.
And there are other people that will come in, it's more my style to say, okay, I see what this is. How do I enhance this? Not saying that what was there wasn't good, mm-hmm. but you're bringing me here to add something else to it. Mm-hmm. So how do I do that but still give you what you want?
Right.
And so doing a pilot or the first episode, when you talk about fingerprints, it's all about taking this pilot script and saying, how do I create a world around this that's going to mean something to people? For Kanan, it was 1991, you know, South Jamaica, Queens. Mm-hmm. That made sense to me. I graduated high school in 91.
Sure.
My aunt lived in Queens, bought my clothes from there. So creating that nostalgia to make you feel a certain way was important. All American, it was creating a balance between, you know, South Central and Beverly Hills, and not making Beverly Hills seem all amazing and South Central all terrible.
Now, but did you utilize any of your George School experiences with that? Because that's you lived that life.
Like,
you're from Philly.
Yeah.
But then we went to this ritzy boarding school.
I did.
So I don't know. But you probably didn't on purpose pull those experiences.
Well, No. Well, I think it was just a matter of humanizing everybody, right? It was a matter of just showing that, like, these are some of the here's what made coming from South Central or Philly special. Art, culture, you know, your mom is there, there's love, there's pride, your room is clean, and you got all your icons on the wall, versus you go across, and then, but then you're dealing with the fact of rejection, because you went to the private school, or you went to Beverly, that your people think you kind of sold out, you left us behind.
Yep.
And then what happens when you get to the land of milk and honey, and they don't necessarily always accept you, you know what I'm saying? Or maybe those kids act out because their parents don't give them the love, mm-hmm. or don't give them the attention. You know what I'm saying? So it's creating a balance to where, you know, you see that both sides have beauty and, you know, they have thorns at the same time. And so being able to put fingerprints on that. And again, going back to fingerprints, I discovered Nipsey Hussle in researching to do that pilot. Mm-hmm. So all the music in that pilot and the clothes were all inspired by him.
Oh, nice.
And this was before, this is like when the album first dropped.
Nice.
So
I like it.
Being able to discover him and he's here and that's, and there's a marathon store and blah, blah, blah. He was like our guy.
That's dope.
And he was supposed to be in the finale, but it didn't happen. And then we lost him in between seasons 1 and 2.
Dang. All right. So I got to hop on over. Oh, first, before I do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So we've been saying this whole mythological high school thing. Sarah Lukens got on. We went to school with Sarah. She got on me. Said, why don't you shout it out? The name of our high school is called George School.
George
School.
So
there you go, Sarah.
I don't think I ever knew that.
Really? Yeah. There it is. George School in Newtown, Pennsylvania. So yes. There you go, Sarah. I shout it out. GS, you need to give her a check.
Cause she went about 30 minutes outside of Philadelphia.
That's,
you know,
right.
30
minutes
amazing
outside
spot.
Of Trenton.
Yes.
Where weekend runs were made. Anyway, so.
It's the only reason why I all bought my K-Swiss.
So.
I want to go back to the creativity part real quick.
Yeah.
We got past it real, real fast. You worked in a bunch of different worlds. Obviously, I want to stick to the TV side for a second. Working in a Vampire Diaries world, mm-hmm. and somebody like Julie Plec, who I think is a freaking genius, mm-hmm. just with how she writes, where she creates from, and then, you know, doing some of the Raising Kanan stuff and working on that Green Light Gang stuff with the world that, you know, 50 has created, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Which one is the more enjoyable one from a director's standpoint to take those stories and add your touch to for you as a director? And if you were a writer, which one of those ways would you sway to?
So creatively, they're both very different for different reasons. Julie Plec, shout out to Julie, because she, you know, gave me a shot when she had the number one show on CW and I was new. So that was a huge deal. And they shot that in Lithonia. Shout out to the East Side. Mm-hmm. But Vampire Diaries had a very specific mythology as far as how it worked and what happened and how you do certain things. So there were a lot more things that I needed to follow and understand to be able to tell that story. And when we first started, so much of the visual effects were in camera. So it wasn't like you could send this off to the visual person. It was, if somebody's vamping, meaning running from one part of the room to the other, you would have the real actor step out of frame, you whip the camera, and then the other actor jumps in and you blow some wind, and that's how it was all done. Yeah. And you put it all together and it looks amazing. So much of what they had was about that and the mythology, which I loved. The Powerverse, and shout out to 50 Cent and shout out to Courtney Kemp.
You know, forgive me, Courtney. I'm sorry.
Nah, it's all good. It's all good. So, you know, writer, showrunner, created that whole universe. You know, and both of them together as this, you know, Titan duo. What I liked about that is that it was, it felt very relatable. The first Power to me, and we've talked about this, me and a bunch of friends, it's about a guy who ultimately wants to be his true self. And what happens when the system around you, your wife, your best friend, have a vested stake in you not changing, mm-hmm. and you being who they want you to be because it's safe for them. And there's somebody over here who sees you for who you want to be. To me, that was the whole allure of that story set in the streets. And so just as a guy, you know what I'm saying, who's been in relationships and I'm a married guy, the idea of examining that really, really resonated with me.
Mm. Okay, I want to hop out of TV and film something real quick. We're going to let people into our behind the curtain a little bit.
Okay.
On some of our phone conversations.
I'm all the way out on these, huh? I'm going to go ahead and leave.
No, you know, because a lot of our conversations are the same.
Okay.
I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this, just in, so with all of it is just your, not me leading you into something. All right, you have this microphone. You were standing in front of the black culture.
Black culture.
Right. Okay. Not even just the black community. You're standing in front of black culture.
Yeah.
What would Rob say to black culture right now today? What would you say to them? Because it's going to come from a place of how you feel about it, where we came from, where we're going, our present. What would Rob say to black culture? Uncle Rob. We're going to call you Uncle Rob on this one.
What I would say to black culture is we set the creative cultural tone for the world. And there's a lot of power in that. And a lot of times I think that we shortchange ourselves. Mm-hmm. We put ourselves in a box and say, our culture is only this. You have to come
from. We do that.
We internally. Mm-hmm. We have to come from these places. We live in these places, as opposed to embracing the entire experience of what it means to be us. I would also say that we have a lot more power as far as shaping America if we would lean into really understanding what's happening and not just going off of what an entertainer or an athlete or whatever said, but the information is there. And I think that if we pay attention, you know, there are things that we can do politically, voting wise, or in our own community to make things better for each other. But culture, it can't just be about getting money. Getting money's great. Can't just be about shining on the gram or TikTok or Twitch or insert platform. We got to be able to do stuff to make a pathway for other people that look like us. And if somebody, you know, doesn't appreciate it, that's cool. You just putting it out there for the culture, because somebody is going to get one of those crumbs, and that's how we all come up. But I think if we just make it about ourselves and what we do, and we're irresponsible with our platforms, then we're going to suffer as a community. And even if you get some money and you move out and you the rich person in the house, then, you know, who your kids gonna play with? You know what I'm saying? Mm. Who's gonna come to your defense if something's not right? So that's why we gotta take care of each other. We can still be fly. And we have to understand why we all have a seat at the table. You know what I'm saying? Whether you super conservative or whether you are hoodtastic or in between, is room for everybody.
Very well put.
Yeah.
Very well put. Let me get y'all's take on this, because okay. I said this to someone one day. You know me, it just comes off the top, right? And after I said it, I was like, I said, I need to unpack that and make sure what I said really makes sense. Let me get y'all's opinion, because you said it's not about getting money. I was talking to high schoolers, and I told them, I said, there's three types of money, the way we see it. I said, you can either get money, earn money, or make money. And I was like, our culture is all about getting money. Now, to me, getting money has no parameters. It's taking it from one place and putting it into your possession. Legally, illegally, morally, immorally, whatever.
Okay.
The object is to get the money.
Okay.
Second is to earn money. Now we're talking about an exchange. I give you goods or services. In return, you give me money. All right? Then there is making the money. This is where you're out of the picture. This is where the money is creating itself. And I was telling them, ultimately, that's where we want to get. You want to get to the point where the money is growing on its own. But we're so focused on the getting money, not understanding what getting money means and what it doesn't mean. That's how I broke it down to them. Would y'all ride with that? Would y'all clarify that? Would you expound on that? What
I like how Rob looked at me. Huh? He was like, what you think, Jay? I don't think I have anything to add so much to it. I think breaking it down simplistically, obviously, you know, I'm a gray area person. So a lot of that stuff blends and merges, and sometimes one can't necessarily happen until something else happens in another one. So I think for simplifying it for younger minds to be able to digest it before they've gotten out there with their first real job or getting into investing or doing anything, I think that's a good way to simplify for an introduction. But I think it gets more complex as you
It absolutely does. I agree with that. Because you got to like earn the money before you can have
exactly.
it.
Exactly. So yeah, I wouldn't add anything to it. If we're using it for what you were talking to kids. Right?
It's just as far as when you're setting those goals,
yeah,
right. And aspiring, like
no, I think for simple purposes, and even with some adults, because some adults still have very immature minds when it comes to how finances work in general. So I think that's an effective way of teaching it.
You good with that?
Yeah, I am. I would agree with that. I would say that as you talk about making money, I would make that to the equivalent of mailbox money, which again, taking it to the youth culture, would be more of a Nipsey Hussle principle of your money makes money where all you gotta do is go to the mailbox and pick it up. I do think
sleep money.
Yeah, there you go.
We call it,
I do think though, just from the get money perspective, that a lot of us, a lot of people, but a lot of us feel like that because if we're struggling to make it, you know what I'm saying, in whatever capacity, I just got to get money to get out of my situation. I was watching an interview with Meek Mills, and he was just talking about how it was all about getting a bag, all about getting money when he was trying to come up, until he was able to break through a certain point. So he wasn't always drowning in debt or drowning in whatever. And then you're able to kind of see what's really happening. It's like, wait a minute. But if you are just trying to get your head above the water, the get money principle might be the only, you know,
like earn money might take too long.
Life preserve. Yeah. Well, the concept of like earn money is like, what are you talking about?
I'll be dead by tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's, a lot of it is perspective. But I think that, you know, again, that's why I feel it's so important that we collectively support each other and invest in things that can help people get money to then, you know, get to the next level, get to the next level. And if it's just about me who got the money and I got mailbox money and I'm over here and everybody else is drowning, well then, you know, collectively we're not going to really come up like we need to.
Yeah, and the balance to that would be, and like I said, because it could be moral, immoral, legal, illegal. So getting money is not the bad part.
Yeah.
But it's within yourself to decide what your parameters are on how you're going to get that money. So getting money is not bad.
I got a question for you about that. Okay. As we're sitting here, you know, in this studio, presumably paid for with legal money, I would offer that, you know, what about situations where you have people that, from what they see and what they come up with, that the idea of doing stuff with a lot of legal money doesn't seem obtainable to them. So then maybe the best that people can see is maybe the illegal flips me to the legal.
Sure.
So, as, you know, what do you say?
It's still so we're going to uncover something, and don't shy away from it, because we are dichotomous on this point. I think it's still a choice, and the reason why I say that is during the summer when I was literally living on the streets on Lawton, you know, on Lawton Avenue, and sleeping on MARTA benches and stuff like that. There was a corner store on Ashby I went into every day, and I contemplated shoplifting every day because I didn't know how I was going to eat.
Sure.
You know what I mean? And so I had that choice. Now, if I had a gun or whatever, it might not just be the Little Debbie snack cakes at that point. It might be robbing it because I needed money. I'm on the street quite literally, and I don't know where my next meal's from. So that's drowning. So I can either go ahead and get my money to survive or not. To me, I had a choice. And I thought of the ramifications, of course, and then I wasn't brought up that way anyway, so that made the decision easier.
Yeah.
But I'm like, do I honestly want to go to jail for this? Right. Or do I want to try to make it last another day on my own with my freedom? To me, it wasn't a hard decision. You know what I mean? So when you say that, for people who feel like they see the studio, yeah, well, the legal way isn't really an option for me, you will always get an argument from that for me. Always. Because to me, it's a cop-out. To me, it's the easy way out. Because a lot of times, doing wrong things is a lot easier than doing the right thing. You'll never get an argument from me from that. You know what I mean? But does that mean that's your only choice? At the end of the day, you'll always get a no, that you always have a choice for it. And we differ on that.
Wait, so. Yeah, a lot. This ain't a shot at you. This is
nah, it's all good.
So why is it got to be a shot at anybody?
Everybody ain't go to the George school, bro. Like some people... Like you just said, you weren't brought up that way. And even when we had that conversation the first time and you told that story about you living on the streets, I said, yeah, man, but you could have went home. Like, you still could have went home.
Right.
There was still a safety net there.
Fast.
Like, I got family members. I've been in a situation, there is no safety net. Mm-hmm. So to say that I have a choice with a safety net that I'm ignoring is putting yourself in a position that some people aren't in, which is why I didn't even go that deep as you did, Rob, answering the question. I was just keeping it on surface level because
life on podcast, baby.
When we get all the way into that, into those trenches of, you know, the levels you have to get to before you break through, like even 50 talks about it.
Yeah.
He did an interview recently where he was talking about everybody who's coming out now that's glorifying the lifestyle. He said, you can't believe them because I lived the lifestyle. I came out of the lifestyle. I would never glorify the lifestyle because I finally got to a point to where it's not necessary to glorify, but I didn't have a choice but to do that at that point. Mm-hmm. And there are reasons why, whether it was manipulation, whether it was blackmail, whether it was just the options that he had, and he didn't have someone who was showing him that there was something else. If you don't know, you can't do something different. So that changes what those choices and those options are. So that's the, I'm not going to go all the way out of it, but that's how I feel about it. I will always lean more towards how he painted the picture and leave all of that super high, I don't want to use the same word I always use, just the super positive stuff that you use, that everybody's just got the same opportunities. Well, I can't do that.
So chime in, because you said a phrase that I think is important.
Okay.
You said it changes their choices and options.
Mm-hmm.
I don't disagree with that. The part where you and I go like this is when I say, is when I thought, let's say, put it this way. I thought I understood you to say is that they had no choice or option. Having different choices and options, yes. And I think there's a difference between that and then truly feeling like you have none.
So this
and
is the thing.
For me, I'm just like, I always feel like that.
Rob, know? I hate you feeling get stuck in the middle.
No, no, it's not stuck in the middle. Look, we had this conversation anyway.
I use Schrodinger's street in that example with you. You remember this whole Schrodinger's cat thing that
cats about?
So I use Schrodinger's street. If I don't know that street exists, but there's a street that's there. Is it in reality? Is it actually there? Sure. If it's outside of my knowledge of being there and you ask me, does this street exist there? I can't say yes to that. I don't know. Right. So outside of my understanding, it's not there. So me saying yes to that is not a choice because it's not within my knowledge base.
Gotcha.
So that's the principle and the foundation that I take that on, is that when somebody is outside of knowing anything about those options, no, they don't have. Do those choices exist in reality?
Of course.
Does it exist to that person who doesn't know that it's there? No.
That I agree with you.
And that's why.
You being here helped.
That's why so much of that stuff has to do with exposure.
Right.
Right.
Absolutely.
And you know, it's like, I got friends, I got family members, all the above, you know, where you see, okay, because this is your lived experience, and because, you know what, here's the difference. I was talking to a guy who, you know, had did a bid. And we were just talking about options, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, what would you do with this opportunity? And he was talking about versus, you know, one of his friends who was also in the life, and their perspective was, well, I'm going to take this money and then go do something illegal. And then watching him change his mentality from where it was. Mm-hmm. But just also being able to understand within that conversation that if you are in a certain situation to where that's what you've been seeing and living for so long, that becomes natural. It's almost like, so where the hustle, where the angle? So if you're coming to me with a real opportunity and say, hey, I got this program, and that's been my mentality, then I'm thinking, well, what's in it for you? So let me guess, I'm gonna get over there, you're gonna take advantage of me, you're gonna try to do whatever.
Right.
Well, I'm gonna get you before you get me, because I've had to do that from a survival place.
Yeah. Right.
Again, going back to the Meek Mills of it all, I got to figure out how to, you know, just get to here.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, it's all these sharks swimming around, and I got to have that mentality for survival. Not saying it's right, but I understand that. And then you get up and you say, wow, that program really was real.
Mm-hmm.
Y'all really did just give me the skill to do so-and-so. You really did take me to, and shout out to you, because, you know, we were just here with some younger kids at the studio to show them something different. It's like, wow, this is a real studio, and Justin Bieber was here, and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. Whereas maybe where you are, nobody's saying that you could do that.
Yeah, exposure is what you said. Yeah,
100%.
As a kid. And that's where I got to say my mom.
Exposure with love.
With love. Love. Yeah. For sure.
Yeah,
you can expose.
Yeah.
You can expose some stuff. For sure.
Exposure with love. But it's like, hey, little homie, you can get this too. And you know what I'm going to do?
Yeah.
I'm going to leave the door open for you.
Yeah.
I'm going to leave the door open for you. And that may mean every once in a while you may get a couple dogs that may run in and bite you.
Mm-hmm.
But if the greater good is, I done saved 12 people, but the one dog got in and bit me, then maybe I just got to be more mindful of how to keep the dogs out, but it don't mean that the other 12 people don't deserve
an opportunity. Now you're presenting with talk. So this was good, because I finally now fully understand what you were saying.
I was taking it too literal.
I get it. What? You don't get nothing. I was taking it too literal. All right. So for now, I get the whole unconscious incompetence thing, basically.
I want to ask you this, Rob.
Yeah. I want to talk about RJ.
I don't know what that is. Everything you're talking about is very, very important. The whole, you know, letting the step ladder back down to help the next person up. If you don't read credits like we would, if you aren't following that, who's producing, who's directing, who's doing all that stuff, they don't know Rob's there.
Mm-hmm.
But as we've been talking about, you're the one that's bringing the story, that's telling the story, mm-hmm. so to speak. I mean, you're taking everybody else's ideas and putting them together into what we find out.
And from what I learned, showrunners need to get more credit.
I mean, they do in certain circles. They definitely do. In certain circles, they definitely do. But it's like, how do we make sure your face is the face that, you know, somebody like me, a younger kid that's, you know, like 20, who is trying to get their first PA gig, because they don't know. All they see is the writer and the actors sometimes, if they aren't diving deeper. Mm-hmm. Getting their hands to you or the person who is you for that inspiration, what are some ideas that you may have been bouncing around, or some things that you started that we could help perpetuate that? Because he and I have had this conversation a bunch of times where I almost think, especially in the music side, rap specifically, that it may be a lost cause, because I think we've gotten too far away from the positives to be able to even offer anything to the next one. We still have you out there making stuff. You know, Will's still doing stuff. Like, mm-hmm. What do we do?
I think if you are a young person wanting to come up and do things in this business, and you're looking for a way in, and you're looking to connect with people like me, if you're on a high school level, a great way to start that is through your programs that do arts, you know, same thing through your churches, and then tell whoever the teacher is, whoever the minister is, whoever the instructor is, hey, can we have a presentation, or can we do a showcase and invite people like these out? If you're a little bit more advanced than that, in Georgia, there's the Georgia Film Office. Mm-hmm. You know, look, and they'll give you a list of all the productions and find out which ones are things that you think that you may like. Like Kevin Hart's got a production that's about to happen. Reasonable Doubt that is about to happen here. And then reach out to the production coordinator and say, hey, here's who I am. I'd love to sit down and just meet with somebody. I think the more that you put yourself out there, the more that you'll see that there are those programs. For me specifically, we have a partnership with the city of East Point. Okay. We have a program called the Amazing Stories Foundation.
Yeah, I love
and that program is all about going into our communities and training people to be production assistants on film and TV sets. Mm-hmm. So I'm looking for people like this. And we love everybody. But my thing is that here's an opportunity to open the ladder, because a lot of times when I was on shows, I might be the only person, one of the only few people that look like me. And I would see everybody else getting a chance. Mm-hmm. I would see people that I knew were former, you know, gang members from other ethnicities. And I love the fact that they get an opportunity, and they should. I also think that we can get some of those opportunities too. And so rather than looking for somebody else to provide that, I feel like if I'm in a position, without hurting myself, to offer some of that too, I want to do that. And then the brass tacks is, all right, if you want those 12s that come through the door, you know what the angle is. You want to know, you know, what the scheme is that you got to pay that back. Mm-hmm. You have to pay me no money. You have to give me no praise. You don't have to say, Rob Hardy did. I don't care about that. What I care about is you do your own version of that from somebody else. So shout out to Nina Packer, who's my partner in crime with Amazing Stories. And shout out to the great Sean Hardy for the support, so that way I can do that.
I'm glad you're still doing that. Yeah. It's been, what, 3, 4, 5 years going now?
We're about to start season six.
Six.
In 2018.
I love it. You said something just now, I don't want to gloss over. You said, as long as I can do that and it doesn't hurt me.
Yes.
What do you mean by that?
I think that any time that you put yourself out there to open the door for somebody, there's some kind of a risk involved.
Absolutely.
So I think it's a matter of figuring out ways that you can help people and minimize your personal risk. Whether that's your family members, whether that's a program, your community, you got to do things to be able to say, listen, I got to make sure that I'm good and that my family's good. That makes logical sense. Mm-hmm. So I can't burn down my house to save you, because we all going to be homeless.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But if I'm good in here, then what can I create out here that gives you the tools and the opportunities to do the same for yourself, provide that you continue to flip that and you continue to protect yourself?
You're verbalizing a lot of things really well today, which is why I want to jump on them, because I get that a lot.
Yeah.
You know, and people always wonder, how come you're not reaching back at me, not helping me and this and that. And like, I just had an Instagram with someone and they were like, hey, you're in the music, I want a business, we need to link up. I said, sure, what do you have in mind? I don't mind. You know me, I'll connect, mm-hmm. I'll link up. He says, well, I don't know yet. I just know you're in music, I'm in music, we can figure this out. And I'm like, no.
Right.
But then how do I say no and you feel like I'm not trying to help you? And I love the way you said that, because you got to, like, because the moment I do that and there's nothing in it for me really except helping you, I'm pulling that time and energy away from something that, let's keep it real, right? I could be getting paid for. You know what I'm saying? I can be keeping my house for. I can be taking care of my family with. That'll lead me to my next venture. So it's not that I don't want to help you, but it's like there's got to be something give. So I love the way you phrase that so that it's not as safe. It doesn't hurt me because that hurt doesn't necessarily mean pain. It just right. means like I need to reserve where I am. I keep saying RJ. So Junior, Robert Junior.
Yes, the third. Yes,
the third.
My son. Yes.
Oh, sorry. He's yeah, not yeah, RJ. Yeah, he's, yeah. A third. He's the third. That's yeah. third what it is. Yeah. RJ. Okay. That's yeah. right. Because even when I text RJ, he ain't saying nothing back. I was like, ooh.
Yeah.
Am I thinking the wrong one?
You're calling the wrong thing.
RJ. Yeah, I'm thinking the wrong one. Please, they got to know about this. I'm so proud of him for this. And yeah, break down what it is that he's doing right now.
Yeah, my son is a high school student, and he is into, you know, his sports and all of that kind of stuff. But he's also into tech. So that's what he likes. And so he sees me go and do the amazing stories outside of directing, producing. And his mom, my wife, drills into him that it can't just be about you. So, you know, we challenged him to find a way where he can give back outside of us doing Hosea Feeds the Homeless. Shout out to them as well. But that could be his own thing. So he founded an organization, Project Ujima Code, where he's able to teach kids from our communities that are middle schoolers how to code. So each semester has its own theme. He partnered with an organization that's here. Shout out to Horizons Atlanta. And so we had a group of students that were learning how to create music and create beats. And they did a big showcase for their families or whatever.
And sorry, I got to say, learning how to create music and beats through code.
Through coding.
That's the thing.
The whole thing is I'm going to show you how to use coding, use technology to do stuff that's cool. Mm-hmm. And then you realize, wait a minute. This can be fun, but on the coding side, you learn the mathematical equations.
Yep.
This plus this plus this plus this. Here's how this works. Now, here's how this works in film. Here's how this works in robotics. And then you feel, and then when your parents see you demonstrate it, then your parents feel from wherever they are, oh yeah, my kid did this and that. And then two classes later, the cousin shows up.
Mm-hmm.
And again, shout out to you and your staff, you know what I'm saying? Because, you know, you opened up the studio so that way we could bring the kids in, and then they were able to bring up their beats in front of real producers. Mm-hmm. And my son was able to show the coding. But the whole thing is to say, here's a fun way to learn new technology and you can do it.
Love it.
Then we're gonna take you to a real place where professionals do it that do big hits and they wanna hear from you. And then now you see I'm in these situations and I've learned a skill and now I can do that.
Mm-hmm. And then these guys don't even know how to do what your son's doing. Like a lot of these producers, I mean, they don't know how to code and make beats. I was talking to two guys, right? I was with Kendrick. Dean, what do we, and I mentioned it to him. He was like, what do you mean coding to make beats? And kid just got hit.
Yeah.
And it's nothing against him. It's a new thing.
Kid is also in tech too. Doesn't kid
code? He's definitely in tech. And so, I mean, your son is on the edge of something. Like, I'm so happy for y'all, bro. Like, seriously.
I appreciate it. And the bigger thing for me, you know, was I just want you to understand that as you come up and you are blessed with so much, find your own way of doing a give back.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Just whatever that is. You know what I'm saying? And what's funny is one of the kids in that program, she sang the Star Spangled Banner at the last Falcons home game.
Nice.
We looked up and I was like, hey, isn't that so-and-so from Ujima Code? And it was her.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you know, again, the thing is that whether you're 17 or 70, you know what I'm saying? Whether you're for Atlanta, Adamsville, Atlanta, Austell, or Alpharetta, you got something you can give back.
Mm-hmm. We usually close sometimes with like rapid fire questions. I want to ask you some, but
cool.
I have to address the So-So Def moniker.
Yes.
Thank you. So y'all already know I used to work at So-So Def. Shout out to Ian Burke and Jermaine Dupri for the opportunity.
100%.
That was awesome. But I've never seen this jacket. Like I got the varsity jacket.
Okay.
But I've never seen this. Where did you get this from?
So this came out a few years back. So it was a collab between So-So Def and Adidas. And I'm an Adidas guy. So when I saw it, I was like, yo, I got to get that. And it meant a lot to me because when I first moved here, Social Def, along with LaFace and Rowdy Records and Two Short Records and all of that was really, really popping. And I had a relationship with Lil Jon. And met him back when he stayed off Ashby Street, you know, with the whole, you know, Black Market Entertainment crew. So shout out to Vince and Rob and Polo the Don and all them guys over there. And at the time, there was a song out, My Boo, by the Ghost Town DJs, and it was on that Social Def bass compilation album. And I'm just coming out of FAMU, you know what I'm saying, Tallahassee. I'm like, yo, I need to direct that video. I got two under my belt. John, I'm your guy. He was like, all right, Rob, you know what I'm saying, come holler at me. And so he and I had been talking off and on, and I think his car was down or whatever, so I was driving him, you know, to the office for a bit and, you know,
he was picking him up from home and...
Literally,
basically, you were chauffeuring him for a little bit.
For like a week.
What?
But at the time, that was my hustle because I'm like, I got the A&R right here, and he's got the plug, and I got movie ideas and video stuff. Okay. So to me, it's whatever. And I'm brand new, and I'm already, you know, a starving artist, so whatever.
Right.
And it's John, and he was mad cool. So we going back and forth, and then, you know, like, and like Goody Mob is shooting a video over here, or no, I think it was like the Witch Doctor was shooting a video. And so then I discovered that, you know, they had just shot the video for My Boo, and I was like, John. Oh. He was like, man, my bad, Rob Hardy, my bad.
You told him that you wanted to shoot the video, right?
Yes.
Why are you driving Miss Daisy, but driving Mr. John?
But I think what it was is that I mentioned that off the top. And then over time, that probably just went out the window. Yeah, yeah. And it was more so like, nah, he just trying to get on. But then me and him, you know, we kept kicking it, you know, when he first dropped his first hit. I saw him at the club in Miami. He was like, Rob Hardy. He had like the huge velvet ear, you know, so
Did anything come? Because sometimes the relationship, just for the relationship itself, can be a blessing. So not every relationship has to, you got to get something out of it.
Yeah.
But has anything come out of your relationship with Lil Jon at all?
Not directly, but what did come out of it was around Lil Jon, I met Vince Phillips.
Yes.
You know, good brother, you know what I'm saying? And we've, you know, been able to work around each other for a bit. I met Bone Crusher, who you know, work
never upset.
Bone Crusher is one of the most amazing people. Yeah. He worked on Twa. He was in Twa the Escort. No. He was in Motives 2 with us. You know, we had his music in Stomp the Yard. Yeah. So, and we had Lil Jon's music in Stomp the Yard. All of that has kind of been like, you know, a nice situation and just good dudes all around.
Just good people to know. That's awesome. That's fine.
Yeah.
Chauffeuring Lil Jon
around. No, but listen, man. But you know what, though? I'm going to say this. I would do that all over again 50 times. I remember me and Will, we found Jermaine Dupri's house and we like left packages for him in his mailbox about movie projects. Up on Dominique Wilkins and VIP at 112. Like, all I need is $1 million for my movie. He was like, oh my God, get away from me. Get away from me. Get away from me. Oh my God.
And all I need is
$1 million. $1 million. You know, and listen, that's why I don't trip off cats saying the same thing. Because when you're starting out, you do everything that you can think of to make it. And when all that dries up, then what? Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the then what is what makes it happen for you.
Yeah. I miss those days. And I'm not going to say they're gone.
I don't. Oh, you mean
the
in
days
general?
Of that hustle. Of
not
that,
for you.
Of that feet on the ground. Yeah. Hustle, because we did the same with the Jack the Rappers and running up and, you know, just stand outside of the office till they come out, then you just bust out in harmony.
Yeah, 100%. Yes, 100%.
Like I kind of miss those. Like when you were going through it, you didn't miss, you it. Miss it. But when you look back, you realize that created something in you. You know what I mean? I don't want to sound like the old uncle.
No, it was
I think
love.
They're missing out on that stuff, though.
I don't know. So I'm obviously I'm a little bit younger.
Yes.
So
that's true.
It was a little bit different for us.
A little bit different, yeah.
Because it was y'all. We was knocking on the door.
It was sending that DM.
It was a little. I'm not gonna say it was more stressful. I think if it still had that personal touch to it, sure.
Yeah.
Ours was, man. Oh yeah, mail me a text, and it was like you was always waiting for a call back or seeing that they were gonna respond to the email or something like that. And every once in a while they did. And I told a story when Troy was here. Like, I hit Troy Taylor up on MySpace one time, and he listened to a bunch of my stuff. Yeah. And he was like, man, you sound like you're already on your way, man. Keep working. And if you're ever in Atlanta, holler at me. And I was like, yo, that's dope.
Yeah.
And then I didn't make it to Atlanta for 5 years.
You're right about the personal, because it was something about...
That was the thing that was missing. Being able to get to him.
Yeah.
I bet you if I was to ask, and I say I got to work with Dominique a lot, because once he became kind of got into the broadcast and stuff, he would tell stories like that of just running into random people all the time. Yeah. He remembers those stories. Yeah. So it leaves an impression.
Yeah.
And I think that by the time I was trying to break in, you know, 01, 02, 05, you couldn't touch people that
you
easily.
Were a digital coach.
Exactly. People would say, oh man, here's my MySpace link, and that's all you had. So it changed it. So I don't miss it because it was lacking that that personal face to face. So there's a reason for me saying it. I wasn't just being facetious.
You were just trying to
call old. No, it was it was different. I think the grit that came from what y'all had to go through was different. There was something that was built in us having to do the same thing, though. I mean, again, different, but we had to find more creative ways because we just couldn't get to you.
Right.
Like, the address for the record label used to be the actual address, and then it became a P.O. box for us.
And there was a whole directory.
Yeah, exactly.
For it back in the day.
Yeah,
it sure was.
There was a whole directory.
So, yeah, it was. You were forced to become a little, I'm not going to say a little more creative, because y'all did some creative stuff, dude. I don't know how you got to
them. I sent CDs and FedEx packages in Frosted Flakes box.
Yeah.
In fact, because I found out that was his the A&R. Favorite cereal.
Mm-hmm.
So I sent him Frosted Flakes box in FedEx package, and he laughed his butt off.
Oh, that's nice.
I tried to get a call about it, but he called me about that. He said, I am laughing my A off right now. He said, first of all, how the F did you know this was my favorite cereal?
Right.
He said, this is the most creative thing I've ever seen in my life. And he know what? Whenever I emailed him, he always emailed me back. Yep. Never got a project from me. Mm-hmm. But at that point going forward, he always returned my emails.
Right.
And I made sure I didn't flood him with it, of course.
Cool.
All right. Five quick questions for you.
Boom.
If you ever want to say pass, you have the right to say pass.
Okay.
All right. Right off the top, what's your biggest insecurity? I forgot to say these are going to be vulnerable questions.
And so here's why, too. So who is this podcast?
He's like, yo, so what's your biggest insecurity?
He was thinking, like, what was the most favorite movie you did?
Yeah, exactly.
He's like, we just got to talk about cereal. Like, what's your favorite cereal?
So one of the things on here is one of the biggest compliments we got is people feel like Johnny and I are, they feel like they know us. And it's super personal. So we have you on here as Rob Hardy, the director, blah, blah, blah. But like, we about to find out who's Rob. Let's start it off like this, okay? Favorite car, dream car, or what you have?
'67 Corvette Stingray. I don't have it, but Avery Brooks, who played the man called Hawk with Spencer for Hire, had that, and I was like, man, one day I'm gonna have that car.
Okay, you've had that stored in you for a minute.
It's either that or the Smokey and the Bandit Trans Am, 78 Trans Am with the Firebird
on it. Yeah. Absolutely, 100%. All right, fair enough. All right, if you co-wrote the song "My Favorite Things" with Hammerstein and Rodgers, what three things would you list? These are a few of my favorite things.
Oh, my favorite things. A crisp new pair of sneakers.
Brand?
These are all things that you buy. You're not talking about like...
It's up to you. What are your three favorite things?
Okay, cool. So,
That's 68 Transit.
might be one.
A new adventure with friends.
Okay.
A great time with family.
Okay.
And laughter.
All right. Well, that's going to lead me to a question that's not written down, but it sounds like, what's your love language? Do you know? I'm guessing I know from your responses, but what's your love language? Do you know, actually?
Well, you know, I've read the book, but I'm, you know what I'm saying? You know, so I do like stuff like, I think my thing is more like, experiences. So I know that that's not like necessarily a love language, but it's all about having those moments where you can really connect.
So that would probably fall into quality time.
There we go.
Would you say?
There we go.
Yep. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Well, y'all know Rob's love language. It's quality time. All right. If you knew the exact, two more. If you knew the exact date you were going to die, or would you want to know the exact date you were going to die?
No.
Why?
Because if I knew the exact date I was going to die, everything that I did would be about that. And with my personality, I wouldn't be able to get that out of my head. And I'd be like, okay, I got to do this by this to set this up for this. So, you know what I'm saying? So I would probably obsess over that.
Be literally living to die, right?
Yeah. I wouldn't.
That would suck.
Yeah.
All right. Last one. What is one thing you wish more people knew about you that very few people do?
How silly I am. Facts. You know what I'm saying?
Facts. Rob's a goofball?
Yeah. Facts. So
Rob can be dumb.
So I mean, hey, look, I got the whole South Park Family Guy sense of humor. That's
word.
Like
my style. And his is low key, okay. You know, because he's still kind of matureish.
It'll be with that with some Shameless in there. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. No, wait, hold on. So you brought up Family Guy, so you got to get real specific. Is it Peter? Is it Brian? Is it Stewie? Or is it Quagmire type sense of humor? Like which whose jokes are you dropping?
Let me guess what you say.
Okay,
whose jokes you dropping?
Is Quagmire
like
the dog?
No, that's Brian.
That's Brian.
I'm going to say Brian, but who would you say?
I say it's a mix between Peter and Quagmire.
Oh, way off.
I wouldn't have got that.
And really? And so that and like I said, like South Park and all of that stuff. I just, you know.
Oh wait, the dog. Okay, my bad. I'm thinking of something else. I'm thinking of the wrong dog. You're right. Now the dog is a little white dog.
Yes.
I was thinking of something.
Yes, Brian.
No, you're not the dog at all.
So yeah, so I'm into all of that.
Okay.
You know
what
I'm saying? So yeah.
Why is that a secret though? Why people don't know? Is that, well, like you gotta be, is it what we were talking about earlier, you gotta be this while you're outside, but then you get to kind of go back to your own little cave and just let loose and be yourself kind of?
Nah, it's more so like I think that when I spend a lot more time at work, there's like my work self that is who I am, but that's not all aspects of who I am. So right. that tends to be more focused and creative. Mm-hmm. So I'm in my creative zone. And then I think that I think that when I kick back with my friends, especially, you know, when we're just, you know, hanging out and we're not pontificating or whatever that right. is,
facts.
You get a chance to kick back and just be silly.
Yeah.
And I love that, where it's not so serious and so much adulting and so much about what's happening in the world or doing whatever. It's just, you're just talking trash, man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's, I'm here for that.
Yeah. Now I don't see that a lot, but I see it. And it gets funny.
You know what I'm saying?
It gets funny.
Hey, you know. Maybe it does, maybe
it
doesn't.
Don't get it on a joke, though.
Hey,
Rob, Rob loves a joke.
You say, I made myself laugh. Is that what it is?
Hey, whatever. Whatever. It's all good. I felt good about it.
There you go.
You know what I'm saying?
Awesome. Yeah. All right, man. Well, look, I appreciate you, homie.
Yeah,
as always, for being here. Nine times out of ten, we'll have you back later down the road as you grow and do more things. But I want to tell the people how they can find you, man. Instagram or whatever it is.
Yeah, so Instagram, it is Real Rob Hardy. R-E-A-L Rob R-O-B Hardy, H-A-R-D-Y. And Twitter, The Real Rob Hardy, T-H-E.
Awesome. We already talked about what's next for you, right? So we're good. Jenny.
Yeah, me? What's up with you? You can find me at Just Johnny Vaughn, JustJohnnyVan.
I owe you an apology off the mic. You can find me, everything's at stonestafford.com, Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook, whatever it is you want, it's right there. And then Everything Life on Podcast, you can binge on the last 12 episodes at lifeonpodcast.com, or they can also lead you to any of the streaming platforms or on YouTube or YouTube channel, which is Life on Podcast. We appreciate y'all. We love y'all. Make your good decisions and be your best. I don't know. That's what it is. Thanks, Rob. Hey. Appreciate you, man. Love you, man. Love you, homie.
Yeah, man.
All right. Be the best version of yourselves. We love y'all. We are out. Peace.